It's an interesting one because sleep needs are quite variable. They do generally reduce over time as kids get older. And you're absolutely right. You know, 7 o'clock might be fine for a four-year-old, but it's not just their circadian rhythm that adapts and adjusts, but also their sleep needs. They physically don't need as much sleep when they get older. My youngest is eight, and she goes to bed usually about 8:30 and wakes up at about 6 or 6:30. 9.5 hours to 10 hours is actually completely normal for an 8 and a bit year old. There's nothing wrong with that, but it sounds kind of horrendous when we've all been indoctrinated with this idea of 7 till 7 bedtimes.
Welcome to the show, I'm Joe Halton. On the Guild of Dads show, we unwrap weekly the incredible stories, skills and expertise of the world's most captivating dads and experts, along with topics and stories that will captivate you and impact your life. If you're an existing listener, thanks for your ongoing support each week. And if you're a new listener, thanks for discovering us. And hopefully the discussions we have will resonate. Make sure you check back through and discover some of the fascinating conversations we have had previously. I appreciate each and every one of you dads tuning in and getting behind the podcast weekly. My dream is to impact as many dads as I can through the conversations I have, and in turn, their wives, families, and society as a whole, which is needed more than ever right now. Because life is tough for dads. We have to learn on the job. Some of us may not have had great role models ourselves, so it's learning, developing, and in growing, we get to impact ourselves and those around us. If you want to reach out to me, you can do so on Instagram and Facebook. We also have a free Facebook group, which is filling up fast with other dads. So join up, introduce yourself over there, and join the guild. Each week, we have fascinating individuals, best-selling authors, entrepreneurs, and ultra-athletes, professors, psychologists, and also some ordinary dads just like you doing some extraordinary and impactful things. We'll give you actionable resources to take away that you can apply to improve your physical health, mental health, relationships, career, and the way you show up in the world as a role model to the next generation. Important conversations, because the world is shifting so fast right now, and getting clarity on this stuff means you can make an impact on yourself and become the role model you always wanted to be to your kids. So today's episode is all about sleep, specifically your child's sleep. It's one of the biggest fears of new parents, how they will function on less sleep. It's one of the biggest concerns of existing parents, whether their kids are going to get enough sleep. And for some parents, it's the biggest frustration of all. My kid or kids just won't sleep, and the advice on it changes daily. Parents beat themselves up about it more than any other subject alongside food. So on today's conversation, we tackle some of the facts and the fiction around this subject head on. Today, I speak to author of the new book, Still Awake, Responsive Sleep Tools for Toddlers to Tweens, international speaker on infant feeding, behavior and sleep, pediatric nurse, and co-founder of the holistic sleep coaching program, Lindsay Hookway. Lindsay has worked with infants, children, and families for almost 20 years, and with a background in pediatric nursing and public health nursing, as well as being internationally board certified as a lactation consultant. She serves both families and professionals with her wealth of knowledge in infant feeding and behaviour, sleep and parenting. If you ever wondered how some of my amazing guests get to where they are in life, the athletes, the entrepreneurs, those making a massive impact on the world, I can tell you that pretty much all of them follow a very deliberate plan or system. This is exactly what I do too, and I'm revealing how you can implement a plan and system in your own life completely free in my ebook, The Dad Blueprint, over at guildofdads.com/dad, and that's dad in capital letters, D-A-D. Incidentally, many of the people I interview on this show will be leveraging the power of similar systems to radically level up their lives and transform into the men and dads they always wanted to be. So you will be in amazing company. And now, to my conversation with Lindsay Hookway. Lindsay, welcome to the Guild of Dads podcast.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Likewise. I'm really interested in speaking to you today because we're going to be talking about the subject of sleep in terms of toddlers right the way through to tweens. Now, as I said to you off air before we kind of got into this, when mine are 9 and 11 now, I should know my kids' ages, but it always kind of evades me when I try and get from my head. And when we had them, people, with what amazes me about kind of pediatrics is that what you were told 1 year is not what you're being told the next year. It's a constantly evolving thing. And now more than ever, there's more information than we've ever had. But like, we were kind of given the option. We were pretty much told, right, with sleep, you need to get your sleep hygiene nailed down, and controlled crying is a way forward. We went with that, and our kids sleep and have always slept kind of reasonably well. But conversely, we know people that did that and their kids didn't sleep very well. We know people that didn't do that and their kids slept well, or they didn't sleep well. So there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason. But I'm absolutely fascinated to find out where stuff has moved on since 2009 and 2012 in terms of what there is options available on this.
Well, I don't think necessarily, I think people are talking about it more. And I think a lot of the information that previously was quite hard to find is much more mainstream and accessible. So, you know, some of the stuff that I talk about isn't necessarily new or innovative, but I'm sort of applying various aspects of child development and psychology and attachment theory and all sorts of other things to the world of sleep to kind of pull it all together, I suppose. I mean, there are so many different ways of dealing with sleep. It's really fun, actually, when you, particularly with older kids, because there are so many ways that you can support their sleep without actually focusing directly on sleep, because sleep is often a symptom. And it's so multifactorial, which is part of the reason for your comment about, you know people who did sleep train or they didn't, and some kids sleep and some don't. And it seems to be a little bit random at times. And I don't necessarily think it is random. I think that there's a lot of genetics. There's a lot of environmental stuff at play. Lots of things to do with lifestyle and personality and underlying anxieties and relationship strain and all kinds of stuff, which is what makes sleep a bit of a puzzle, I suppose.
Yeah, it's interesting. And do you think that it's something that kind of parents, I mean, I know what I hear from dads, it's something that parents really beat themselves up about, because often if they've been told to do it a certain way and it's not working, or, you know, someone will say, well, the reason it's not working is because you've not done it for 3 months and stuck with it. And they're like, it's just not working after not even like a week of doing it. And it's kind of like, there's so much information now that you've got someone on the internet telling you should do it this way, your mother-in-law telling you should do it this way, your mum and dad telling you, well, we never did it that way. And then all of a sudden you're kind of like, well, what the hell do I do? How do you kind of get around that kind of mindset that parents are in, Lindsay? Because surely parents must come to you at that stage where they're just like, I just don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do. Is there a starting point from which you go?
I think there is. I think it starts from what you feel comfortable with and, you know, what is the thing that is driving you nuts? Let's be really, really specific about that. So is it a bedtime that's taking 2 hours? Is it, you know, a little midnight visitor? Is it, you know, kids waking up at the crack of dawn or whatever it is? Let's start by first of all being really specific, and then let's talk about your child. Let's talk about their personality, their character, their temperament, their, you know, let's talk about boundaries, let's talk about loving limits, let's talk about being age appropriate, let's talk about being firm and kind at the same time, which is possible. Let's talk about all the, you know, the family contextual stresses that are going on, and let's just chip away at some of that, because sometimes you're right, when people start Googling, they fall down a kind of Google black hole at 2 o'clock in the morning. And some parents get into a kind of fix it mentality. Sometimes that's dads, sometimes that's mums, sometimes that's others, to be quite honest. But sometimes people will go, right, okay, what we've got to do is X, Y, Z. Whereas perhaps other parents are more intuitive, and they need to actually, you know, remember what their own intuition feels like and go with something that feels comfortable for them, if that makes any sense. But I agree, it's completely overwhelming, and there are so many opinions and ideas and options. And I think, in a way, you know, you were saying at the outset of this, that it felt like, you know, 12 years ago you didn't really have much information, and now we've got information overload. And I think I don't know what the right balance is, because it doesn't feel like information overload is the right place to be, although at least we do have more options now, don't we?
Yeah, and I think the thing is that I'll never forget a family friend of ours, and he had seven kids, a mixture of foster kids and his own kids. And he turned to me very shortly after, when we were at a family event, and I think the kids were playing in the garden, whatever. And he turned to me, and he put his hand on my arm, and he said, "Oh, trust your instinct, because it's very rarely wrong when it comes to raising kids." And I always remember that, because that kind of became like a guiding light for us, particularly when the kids were young. Because, you know, for instance, like I remember in the summer once, and it was really hot, and my wife was breastfeeding our eldest, and my mother-in-law said, "Oh, you can sterilize some water and give them a little bit of water if you want, that's fine," and whatever. And we were like, "Oh no, the midwife said that they get all of the water they need from the milk, so there's no need for us to give them any water." And in the end, you get in this kind of mental battle of should I, shouldn't I. And in the end, we just said, "Oh, it's not going to hurt them." And she loved a nice sip of cold water, not loads, but just like a thimbleful sort of thing. But I think it's tapping into, like you said, that intuition where you're like, actually, I can make my own decision on this. I don't need to run it by the kind of the gods of pediatrics on every single decision I make. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I absolutely know what you mean. I often say to people, look, if it feels wrong, it probably is wrong. I think the trouble is, though, that although everyone does have intuition and instinct, it can kind of become drowned out by some of the noise. Mm-hmm. You know, all of the voices, the social media, the peer input, the mother-in-law input, the mum input, the, you know, great auntie Mabel, next door neighbours, you know, everyone's got an opinion on how you should raise your kids. Even the, you know, the people in the checkout queue at the supermarket have got an opinion on, you know, what you should be doing or not doing with your children. And it's really, really confusing. And sometimes just trying to listen to that still small voice in your gut is actually harder than it sounds. It sounds really easy, doesn't it, to just trust your gut instinct. But I think we have to remember that we've, you know, over the last sort of a couple of hundred years, we've done a bit of a number on our instinct, because, you know, even going back 200 years, some, you know, a big group of medical professionals mostly started telling parents that actually you shouldn't raise your children like this. You should, you know, raise them, you know, on this prescribed schedule that, you know, that we've written down for you. And this is how you should be feeding your babies, and this is what you should be doing to your babies, and you should ignore them, and you should teach them that they should be seen and not heard, and all of this stuff. And actually, when you think about it, we've got kind of a couple of hundred years of being told that our instinct is actually wrong, that still small voice in your gut is perhaps not one you should be listening to. Perhaps you should be listening to the people in white coats, because they know better. And I think that's part of the problem. We're just about, I think, as a nation, waking up to the idea that, oh, actually, maybe we can question this. Maybe we can go, how does that sit with my parenting philosophy? And how does that sit with what feels right on the inside? But it's a hard thing to do, because at the same time, you've got all the voices around you, you know, saying, oh, this is the 1, 2, 3 step to better sleep, or the easy solution. This is going to, you know, solve your marriage. This is going to save your mental health. This is going to give you your evenings back, or whatever. It's hard. It's hard to listen to your instinct.
Yeah, and I think, and that kind of rings true with a lot of the conversations I have on here in terms of, you know, people are kind of tuning into their ancestry a bit more. I think just not just in terms of parenting, but also, like, I spoke to a lady, Anna Machin, about her book, and she was saying about the different ways that kind of typically dads get involved in different cultures throughout the world. But what's also kind of interesting is in terms of mental health, we're beginning to like tap into kind of it in the West. We're tapping into, like, you know, more kind of Eastern traditions and Buddhism and mindfulness and all this kind of stuff, which is kind of getting ourselves in alignment with our natural state a bit more than kind of getting pulled into the shoulds and woulds and musts and all the rest of it, which I think is, it's just interesting to watch how we're beginning to kind of become a little bit more intuitive about this kind of stuff, rather than it actually being right, you must do this or you must do that sort of thing, and this kind of overly prescriptive way of doing things.
Yeah, I think we're getting there. I think for a lot of people, myself included, actually, it's quite a cognitive process still, though. So, you know, learning to slow down and say no and put in work-life balance and boundaries and, you know, develop some mindfulness techniques and that kind of thing. It's, for me, certainly, it's still not intuitive. It's something that I have to be disciplined about. But we're definitely getting there, I think, and we're beginning to learn that actually our children need us to model that, and they need us to facilitate that for them as well. So it's, we're getting there.
I like the way you mentioned modeling, actually, because I've noticed, again, one thing, you know, one thing I spoke to you about before we jumped on air was that a lot of dads I hear of are often going to bed very late, using their kids as an alarm clock to get up in the morning. And they might be, you know, they might be eating or drinking late at night or on Netflix or Xbox or whatever it is they're doing and stuff. So it's interesting what you say about role modeling, because I think in my experience, when you start to role model certain behavior, your kids begin to follow suit. And exercise is a really good example of this. When you exercise, children will all of a sudden start exercising. Like, I've downloaded a fitness plan from so-and-so. And you're like, where did you, and you suddenly realize it's because they've been watching you exercising for the last year, 2 years. And so that it becomes second nature, because they are mum and dad exercise. So yeah, that's normal. So we'll just exercise as well, sort of thing.
Yeah. I think, I can't remember who I said this to, but I was talking recently to someone and saying that actually children are naturally egocentric. They do things because they enjoy doing them a lot of the time. And therefore, I think for a lot of kiddies, particularly little kids, they assume that if we spend a lot of time doing something, it must be something we enjoy. And that's really important to know, because if we spend a lot of time working, or we spend a lot of time on our phone, or we spend a lot of time, I don't know, cleaning the house, it's really natural for them to assume, oh, mummy just loves cleaning the toilet. You know, daddy loves going to work and putting in a 14-hour day. It's great. It's just so much fun. But actually, we also need to model resting, and we need to model taking it easy, and we need to model enjoying playing with them and spending time with them and hanging out and going, yeah, of course we're going to watch a movie. Let's sit down and watch Harry Potter together, because actually I really love hanging out with you. And we have to show them, with our behavior as well as with our word, perhaps mostly with our behavior actually, that although work is important, I love telling my girls that actually I really love my job, and I'm so lucky that I've worked hard and I enjoy what I do. It's important, and I need to work, but also I really enjoy the work that I do. I want to model that to them, but I want to model that actually hanging out with them and being offline is more important, because they need to know where they are in the priority pecking order.
Yeah. One of the things I say is that kids want your presence, not your presence. That kind of bears out what you just said there. Do you think that when there is a kind of disconnect, because again, I've spoke to previous guests about this idea of the parent that is physically there but mentally absent, both for mums and dads because of, you know, how the world preoccupies us. Does that have an impact on how child is feeling in the world and their ability to sleep as well? Does that have an impact on the on how well they are able to get to sleep and relax into sleep?
I think it does, but I'm a very hardworking, pragmatic, realistic person, and I think the last thing today's parents need is another load of guilt whacked on their shoulders. I don't think we need to be beating ourselves up about what we don't do. I think we need to focus on what we actually realistically can. I think today's parents are working ridiculously hard. We're pulled in all sorts of different directions, and we probably have less social support than possibly ever before, actually. I don't know if anyone would disagree with me about that, but it's certainly what I see. I see a lot of parents who are, they're not particularly plugged in with their extended family. They're living apart from their families and they're having children later. And it's, you know, a lot of people move away from their friends to get more space, and then they have a family and boom, they've got no social support. So this happens a lot. And I think we need to focus on what we can do. I often talk about two different ways to kind of fill up a child's love tank. I sort of explain that all kids have a love tank. Children speak their own love language. I don't know if you've heard about the love languages before, but it's this concept that we feel most loved when people do particular things. It might be telling us that we love them. It might be showing them. It might be spending time with them or whatever. But there are two ways to fill up that love tank. One is to trickle charge it. And that's basically quantity time. So just spending lots and lots of time with them. And the other way is supercharging it. And I love talking about supercharging because for busy parents who don't have any choice but to put in a 10-hour day at work, they can't do trickle charging because they're not physically there. Mm-hmm. So let's not feel bad about that. Let's instead embrace the fact that we're going to supercharge it. And that means 15 minutes, phones down, phones off, no distractions. Let's just hang out, whether that's playing Just Dance on the computer or sitting down and drawing together or going outside and bouncing on the trampoline or whatever it is, whatever you can do. But focus on, you know, supercharging their love tank. And that it really does make a big difference to kids. If even just that 15 minutes of solid one-to-one time.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting because, funny enough, when I was talking to Anna Machin, she said that in the West, particularly in terms of, I'm going to use the example of dads, but I think it equally applies to mums as well, is that there is where we've got an evolutionary adaptation in that when you're doing the supercharging, as you call it, there is a rush of beta endorphins that goes on in the pair bonding networks of mother and child or father and child because and this comes from the fact that I think in the Western world, obviously, because predominantly historically it's been dad that's the breadwinner. He's out for most of the day, and then when he comes home in the evening, there's a short window of bonding time. So basically nature has found its way of basically supercharging that period. So which is why it's and rough play is another one. Rough play is one that really triggers beta endorphins. And it's quite an interesting, when I heard that, I was like, that makes perfect sense intuitively, but it's interesting to know the science going on behind it.
Yes. And, you know, it's a really important thing to talk about because a lot of people will describe a very similar experience of, again, let's use the example of a dad coming in from work. But often that the dad will be told, oh, I don't get them all ramped up because I'm just trying to get them ready for bed. You know, don't start, you know, looning around playing football or chase or tickle fighting because they're trying to calm down. It's going to be murder to get them into bed otherwise. But I absolutely challenge that. And I say, actually, do you know what? They need that. They need to get some of those frustrations and tensions out of their day. It's a brilliant way of doing it. All animals have the same behavior when they have kind of pent up frustration or tension. They kind of f- physically shake it off. And it's really important. Kids do the same thing. They kind of need to literally shake it off. Mm. So actually that rough and tumble play, that rough housing, we know that that does so much in terms of parent-child bonding. It also teaches them about boundaries. It teaches them about empathy, because they begin to learn where the limits are and, you know, how far they can push it and all of that stuff. It's so important. And actually, yes, maybe you shouldn't go and bounce around on the trampoline and then immediately get into the PJs. That might be a bad idea. But, you know, you can just make a 10-minute space to calm down after the crazy time. I call it silly time. And then do bedtime. And I pretty much guarantee, A, it will improve bonding, and B, it will make kids a bit more physically tired, but C, they'll be more relaxed, because, as you say, all of those endorphins have chilled them out. They've made them, you know, more relaxed and happy. We know that serotonin is the chemical precursor to melatonin. There are so many reasons to do it. So yeah, absolutely. Mm. Let's bring on the silly time.
And do you advocate having that as kind of, like, I've always thought in terms of kind of like wind down zones. So we kind of sort of have like the hour before bed is kind of generally the kind of the quiet and off wind down zone sort of thing. So would you say for the, like, you know, for rough play and crazy time, we do that before the wind down hour, or do you not get into kind of sort of specific segments of time before bedtime at all sort of thing?
I do a little bit, because sleep's basically controlled by two separate regulatory mechanisms. One is your circadian rhythm, and the other is homeostatic sleep pressure, which sounds really nerdy, but it's basically just the drive to fall asleep that builds with the amount of time you spend awake. So as adults, if you've been awake for 18 hours, your sleep pressure is really high. Your body is saying, just go the beep to sleep. You know, we've been up too long now. Now with kids, let's say their circadian driven falling asleep time is 8 o'clock, okay? For about 1 or 2 hours before that regular habitual falling asleep time, the circadian rhythm is actually sending off lots of alerting signals. It's a natural period of wakefulness and alertness. And although the sleep pressure is building during that time, because, you know, by then they've possibly been awake for 10 hours or 12 hours or whatever, actually the circadian rhythm is saying it's not sleep time yet. So that's why putting kids to bed deliberately early usually backfires, because you're actually trying to put them to sleep during that time that's called the wake maintenance zone. So it's that time of circadian driven alertness, and it's just going to go horribly wrong. So you're much better off saying, right, circadian bedtime seems to be 8 o'clock, because we've kept an eye over the last week and they've fallen asleep pretty much within 15 minutes either side of 8 o'clock. That means going to bed any time before about 7:30 is going to be a disaster. So let's just use the time beforehand to get all the silliness out of their system. And then about 30 minutes before that usual falling asleep time, that's the time to start really focusing in. I think you mentioned sleep hygiene before. So really having that gentle, predictable, nurturing routine that they come to expect and understand and all of that good stuff.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that can be really helpful anyway.
And one thing that we got caught out by, and I think a lot of parents do, is like, I don't know, say they're 4 years old, for instance, and they go to bed at 7 o'clock, for argument's sake. You kind of, that's working for a while. And then you're like, hang on a minute, why won't they go to bed? And then you suddenly realize that they're 6 and they're not 4 years old anymore. And you can get stuck in that rut of, well, that worked however many hours ago. And this speaks to exactly what you've just said, isn't it? So their natural sleep is moving a little bit later. Parents are going to be stressing about the fact that, well, hang on a minute, are they going to get enough sleep if they go to bed later? And they, because some kids go to, no matter what, like ours, for example, is this only for, I wouldn't say recent, but they were always like, they'd get up exactly the same time, no matter what time they went to bed, they would get up at exactly the same time. And so what about that for parents, where they're stressing about, are they going to get enough sleep? Is that something to worry about? Or is it just, again, go with the natural flow sort of thing?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one because sleep needs are quite variable. They do generally reduce over time as kids get older. And you're absolutely right. You know, 7 o'clock might be fine for a four-year-old, but it's not just their circadian rhythm that adapts and adjusts, but also their sleep needs. They physically don't need as much sleep when they get older. My youngest is 8, and she goes to bed usually about 8:30 and wakes up at about 6 or 6:30. 9.5 hours to 10 hours is actually completely normal for an 8 and a bit year old. There's nothing wrong with that, but it sounds kind of horrendous when we've all been indoctrinated with this idea of 7 till 7 bedtimes. And, you know, really only children up to about the age of 5 are going to need 12 hours sleep. And that's at a maximum. Some kiddies will never, ever achieve 12 hours of overnight sleep their whole life. I know so many 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds who are not achieving 12 hours of sleep a night. And there has been some research that's found that genuine sleep deprivation, where children aren't getting enough hours of sleep, is associated with poor school performance and memory. And there's a link with higher adiposity, or, you know, greater weight gain and obesity as well. But this is for children who are genuinely sleep deprived. They're not the children who are getting enough sleep, but just perhaps less than we might want as their parents. And they're happy in the day and they're thriving. Those kids are fine. It's the children who are really, really not getting enough hours of sleep. And then we need to look at, well, why aren't they? Is it because there's something bothering them in the middle of the night? Are they itchy? Are they uncomfortable? Do they have, sleep apnea? Are they stressed? Are they anxious? Are they waking up needing a wee? You know, what is it that's disturbing their sleep? Or is it something environmental or to do with boundaries? Like, are they, you know, watching TV and or sneaking the iPad into their room and, you know, watching that late at night? What is it that's stopping them from getting the sleep that they need? But yes, to answer your question, sleep needs reduce over time. And if children are getting the sleep they need, you normally know. Parents are really good at telling whether their kids are basically okay. You know, you look at them, if they're chirpy and, you know, full of energy, they're probably fine. We don't need to overthink it too much.
Yeah. It's really, I like what you just, that last couple of minutes, because a lot of parents hopefully are listening to this thinking, oh, I feel so much better after hearing that. I'm actually doing a lot better than what I thought I was doing.
Yeah,
but again, because of this kind of gold standard that people are kind of held to. And you're right, like, from my personal experience, my eldest is not so bad, but my youngest boy, if she has had a couple of late nights when we've been on holiday or whatever, she is ratty. And then the next day we're like, right, you're going to bed a little bit early tonight, I think.
Yeah.
But you do notice it. But also, like, if they've had a lazy day, as opposed to like running around, like at school, they're worn out when they go to school, when they're worn out when they come back, because they've been running around the playground and doing goodness knows whatever else. If they've had a lazy, rainy day on a Sunday or whatever, they're not going to be as tired as if they were running around all day long. So is it the key to kind of just being a bit more fluid and organic with stuff, depending on how much energy they're expending during the day?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I don't like being prescriptive about sleep, but I kind of like to recommend, you know, sort of 5 a day. So food, fun, connection. So, you know, getting their love tank filled up, exercise and brain stimulation. So if they're mentally stimulated, if they're physically worn out, if they've had, you know, enough food and the right kinds of food, then, you know, not just filling up on cheesy Wotsits and Haribo. You know, no one ever feels good after eating junk food all day, do they? Let's face it. Yeah. But I mean, there are some rough rules of thumb, and definitely, certainly my youngest, if she's been surfing at the weekend and she's spent 4 hours in the sea on her bodyboard, she'll definitely sleep a lot better than if she's messed around, you know, at home and not even gone out for a dog walk. We can physically see the difference. And I think we just need to be mindful of that sometimes, and, you know, be you know, be realistic about when bedtime's going to be if they've had a really, really, really quiet day, or compensate with lots of brain stimulation. So, you know, playing memory games or little card games, board games, scavenger hunt games, all sorts of things you can do to kind of wear them out in another way. One of the things that a lot of parents feel terrible about is, oh my goodness, my child's not going to bed till 9 o'clock. Well, if they're sleeping till seven, that's probably fine, actually. And then the second thing they normally worry about is, oh yeah, but I really need an evening. I kind of need to disconnect from my kids. And I so get that as well. I absolutely understand that, you know, we need to just have some adult time and we need to be kind of done parenting. And I totally get that. But we have to also bear in mind what's realistic and age appropriate and achievable for kiddies, because we can't make them get more sleep than they physically need. It's just going to lead to a really frustrating bedtime.
Yeah. And one thing that I hear dad say a lot to that point, and I think mum as well, is if your kid's going to bed later, it's kind of like, oh, like, actually, the reason I'm going to bed later is I need 2 or 3 hours. I need at least X amount of hours to chill down after the kids have gone to bed and whatever, which you kind of get. Yeah. But the problem is in my experience, that becomes a double-edged sword, because then dads and mums go to bed later, they end up tired in the morning. So one of the things one of the first things I work on with dads, funny enough, is actually them getting to bed earlier and getting up a bit earlier. Because the good thing is A, you're a bit fresher anyway, you're sleeping better, and you know, it doesn't need to be, you know, some personal development gurus will say about 4, half 4, you should get up and whatever. I think for a lot of people, even if they were to get up half an hour earlier, just to do a bit of meditation or journaling or do something, just so they've got a block of you time first thing in the morning, then you're not stressing about whether you've had your you time later on in the day quite the same way. Do you know what I mean? So,
gents, I'm going to jump in here quite quickly. Now, if you're a regular listener, you may or may not know that this year I formed an exclusive brotherhood of dads called the Dad Circle. And some of the men who have joined are making some remarkable changes to their lives, their physical health, mental health, and relationships, accomplishing things that they didn't think were possible for them before joining. As a member, you get access to a proven system of self-improvement, daily accountability check-ins to keep you on track, and weekly team calls, monthly topics and challenges. Not to mention a bunch of other dads encouraging you and cheering you along the way. Now, if this sounds like something that you would benefit from and you want to check it out, then you can do so over at www.thedadcircle.com/join. That's thedadcircle.com/join. If you're driving right now or doing something, do a pause, rewind a few seconds and jot the link down. Then go and check it out. If that wasn't enough, right now you can try it out for £1. That's just £1 for your first 7 days. I can't say fairer than that. £1 could be the best investment you ever make. So try it out today.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, when you're a new parent of a baby, everybody knows that it's going to be hard work. You're going to be awake in the night, et cetera, et cetera. But there's usually they go to bed relatively early in the evening. So you get that time in the evening. And I think we just sometimes as parents just forget that actually as they get older, they're going to go to bed later. And therefore, rather than wring our hands about that and go, oh, my goodness, I'm not going to go to bed till midnight, we need to rethink when we get that downtime. And the good news is we can either do it early in the morning, as you said, and generally speaking, as kids hit the tween years, they'll start waking up later. So that's a winner. Or by the time they're old enough that they are going to bed later, often they are a little bit more self-sufficient. So they can understand that actually, do you know what? You can go and play for half an hour. You can go and sit and read your book for half an hour. That's fine. You don't necessarily need to be with them completely plugged in until 9 o'clock at night. But it's just about rejigging how you do your own self-care and your own time. I think what can be hard is couple time. That for a lot of couples is really difficult. Once you've got kids going to bed really late, sometimes you're going to bed before they are. That's certainly beginning to happen with our eldest.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Just go to bed, will you, please? Because we're going to bed now, sort of thing. And then I'm wandering around and like, what are you doing in the toilet? That you need, why do you keep going to the toilet, mama? But yeah, I've got an 11-year-old, so that it's kind of sort of par for the course, sort of thing. But I think it's really. I think the other thing that I was going to say earlier on in our conversation, but I completely forgot to say it, was that if you're sleep deprived and you're tired and you're stressing about this stuff, you're not thinking straight. Like if you picture being stressed. The typical symptoms of being stressed and anxious and depressed about something, you don't make sound judgments and decisions in that place. So that adds an extra dimension to it, because if you're tired, fed up, anxious about the fact your kid won't sleep, and then you're reading tons of information, then everyone's going like that at you. Yeah. It's not conducive to making sound judgments about stuff at all, is it?
No, it really isn't. And unfortunately, sleep and mental health kind of bi-directional. So if you've, you know, obviously if you're sleep deprived, that makes you feel more depressed and anxious. Absolutely 100% agree with that. But also if you're depressed and anxious, that reduces the quality and quantity of your sleep as well. So it can become a little bit of chicken and egg. You know, was it the depression that's caused the dodgy sleep, or is it the dodgy sleep that's worsened the depression? And often it all gets mixed up into a big ugly melting pot of fatigue and insomnia and all of that. And so that's why the self-care piece and the mental health care piece is really important when you're thinking about children's sleep. Often we look straight to the way the child is sleeping, but actually there are usually some quicker wins and some more sort of sustainable and holistic wins when you look at, well, actually, let's look at all of the contextual factors and make sure that everybody is plugged into the right support.
It's the whole thing. Your outer world is a reflection of your inner world, isn't it? And if mum and dad aren't feeling too great, or there's been a traumatic birth, or there's something residual that she's carrying on, either mum and dad are not getting on or whatever, it impacts the whole family dynamic, and it's going to impact when my old man passed away when I was 36, mm-hmm. and my daughter was, how old was she then? 2050. She was, I guess, 5-6. Again, mm-hmm. you don't realize how these different kind of things that throw a rock into the family dynamic and create a ripple effect. You don't mm-hmm. really realize how much they affect everything until you look back some years later and you're like, oh, that was hard work. And then you suddenly that was going on at that time. That was going on at that time. We're also dealing with that. And then you're like, oh, maybe that's why we were a bit stressed.
I'll do it, definitely. You know, trauma, illness. A few people know that my youngest had leukemia. So, you know, we were dealing with 2.5 years of chemo for her. Absolutely, that had knock-on effects on everybody's sleep, you know, whether it was my sleep because of insomnia and anxiety, or her older sister's sleep because she was being passed from pillar to post and different play dates and all the rest of it, or my youngest sleep when she would come out of hospital and have to, you know, settle back down into being at home again. You know, we have to remember that sleep is often a symptom. It's not something that we can compartmentalize and just deal with in a bubble. We have to look at all of the other bits that affect it. And absolutely, trauma, illness, disruption, family breakdowns, stresses, intergenerational trauma, all sorts of stuff can be a factor. I don't want to, you know, overcomplicate something that sometimes can be handled quite simply, but also we don't want to miss some really important stuff that is bubbling away under the surface.
Yeah. And I often say to dads as well that like, and I use the kind of to get the oxygen mask analogy, you know, that when you go for a safety video on the plane, they get the parents to put the oxygen mask on first. And that's the reason for that, is that you're no good to your kids if you've suffocated through lack of oxygen. Yeah, and I think definitely. Parents really need to kind of buy, I try and encourage dads certainly, and I'm sure people that help mums do the same, is to actually to put themselves first. And people think, well, what do you mean by that? That means surely that I've got to put everyone else last. And it's this bizarre idea of kind of parental martyrdom, I think people get into. But in actual fact, when I say to dads specifically, I say, no, actually, that means that you cover your mental health, physical health, relationship, yeah, et cetera, needs first, then you prioritize your family as part of that. And they're like, oh, I'd never really thought about it that way. Because then dad shows up on his A game, or not his A game, but he shows up as his best self, if you like, yeah, and the same as mum can as well, if they get the same help as well. But it's just this, but again, it's this kind of Victorian thing of, no, I must be at my family's beck and call, otherwise the whole world will fall apart. But it's just simply not going to, do you know what, yeah, I mean? And this comes down to boundaries as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it does. And I think, you know, there's a little bit about teamwork there as well, and yeah, and kind of so much about teamwork, actually, you know, playing to each other's strengths. So I'm not great at silly time, actually. I'm really good at bedtime stories and the wind down piece. My husband's really good at silly time, so he'll go and play football or loon around or you know, muck about with the dog, and the dog punches a football and it's all squealing giggles and all that stuff. That's his forte. That's brilliant. But there'll be times as well when we have to negotiate. We're both up against it. We're both busy. And, you know, that's, yeah, why he's going sailing for 3 days. But then to compensate for that, while I look after the whole, you know, shebang back at home, he's going to take the kids in the camper van for 3 days. It's about give and take. It's about, well, actually, what do you need? What do I need? How can we help each other? How can we have family time? How can we do the things that we've got to do to make ourselves feel better? And of course, that's a very privileged position. First of all, to be able to go away, I fully appreciate that's a privilege, but also it's a privilege to be in a relationship where you have that cohesion. And if you don't, I think that's really difficult for families. And that's where you need that, the trusted people around you, the extended family, the friends that you would, you know, you would literally trust with your life. You need those people around you because, as you say, you need to be able to put your own oxygen mask on first, because you can't pour from an empty cup. If you're completely depleted, of course your kids are going to get short shrift because you've got nothing left. You've not even got enough for yourself, never mind pouring into tiny humans. It's hard.
I think what I've noticed is really hard as well is getting, this is not all mums, but some of the dads that I speak to, it's often mums giving themselves permission to just to do the very same thing that I encourage dads to do. And it's like, sometimes it's like, no, I can't go out and do stuff because it's sort of, you know, I'll be failing as a mum and whatever and stuff. Well, no, dad can go and take them. Dad can go and take them for the day or for a few days or whatever and stuff and that. But it's I always think that it's, if you need time apart with each other, time apart from each other, and then time with the kids individually, as well as with the family together. And I think if you can, it sounds analytical and scientific, but if you can try get most of those boxes ticked on a regular basis, I think you're halfway to quite good harmony. Because like I find that with my daughters, when I spend time with them by myself, there is an afterglow for the few days after that has happened, and you have to keep recharging that afterglow in order to form those bonds with your individual children that you've got, sort of thing. And the afterglow that they get from being with me will be different from being with mum. Like, I went into a nail bar on a Friday afternoon the other weekend with my youngest. And it was like stepping across. I'm going to own it. I was like stepping across the threshold into the sisterhood. And I was like a rabbit in the headlights. And the woman walked up to me and she said, do you want gel or do you want acrylic? And I was like, and then the lady sat next to me, she was like, I don't think you want either of those because they're not allowed them at school. I think you should just go for a colour. And I was like, right, okay, and I'm going to have a colour. And then the lady said, what colour do you want? And I was like, what is there? And she's like, they're all here. And there's like about a 30-foot wall, just floor to ceiling with like nail colours. Yeah. And I was like, dad problems to have.
Whole new world. Wow, that was a proper initiation ceremony there.
I was Friday afternoon in the nail bar. It was just like you could cut through the estrogen with a knife when I walked into that room. Yeah. It was unreal.
Yeah. Well, well done. Kudos to you for doing that.
Thanks very much.
It was meant a lot to them, I'm sure.
Yeah, she loved it. But the point I'm making is I think that doing the little things that you do on an individual level with them is, I think sometimes mum's like, well, dad, he doesn't do it the way that I would do it. He doesn't arrange all the clothes the way I would do it. And the stuff he puts them in when they go out for the day, and it's kind of like, it doesn't really matter.
It really doesn't. It really doesn't matter. And I think we have to remember to let it go. We have to allow ourselves to be unplugged sometimes.
Yeah.
And not care as much as about things like that really don't matter. I think it can be very difficult. I've spoken obviously to hundreds of parents, mums, dads, all sorts of different families. But one of the common things that comes up time and time again is finding it difficult to kind of relinquish control and responsibility, just letting your partner have a go and know they're not going to do it the same way as you would. No, they're not going to dress in the same way. They're not going to put the nappy on the same way. They're not going to, read the bedtime story in the same way, all sorts of things. But actually, do you know what? Just let them have a go, because it's in your confidence in your partner that children pick up on that confidence that it's okay, yeah, daddy can put me to bed, of course he can.
And they do pick up on it as well, because I think they notice if dad's been put in a position of being portrayed as this guy that can't do anything, he's pretty useless sort of thing.
Yeah, it's true. Or they're kind of I think a lot of mums will sort of rush in and rescue when it's not going very well, or you know, they can hear that there's a bit of a negotiation going on, or perhaps people are getting frustrated. And actually, do you know what? Sometimes just having the discipline of going, no, I'm just gonna button it, just take a step back and just let them figure it out. They need to figure it out. It's really important.
Yeah, I always have an interesting one when my youngest says, when mum's out and she says, can I have this from the fridge? And I'm like, oh, okay, does mum let you have those? And she's like, so, because I can always check with mum when she gets back and I will know if you've been telling me fibs. And she was like, yeah, she doesn't let me have them all the time. I said, so does she really let you have them? and she's like, no, only as a special treat. So I think so. Yeah. Rumbled.
Absolutely. You're busted, kiddo.
Busted, yeah.
Absolutely busted. I mean, kids do that from a really young age, and you know, often this takes people by surprise when their kids start pushing the boundaries. But I say to a lot of people, you know, kids don't know where the boundaries are unless they push them, and they kind of push them to see how bendy those boundaries are, and they kind of see if they can get under them, over them. You know, they want to see if both parents have the same boundaries. Is one parent bendier than the other? If they ask when one parent is really tired and cranky and hungry, might the boundary be even more bendy? And it's just completely normal for kids to do that. They're really smart and they're really industrious and tenacious. All the things that we want for them when they're 25, it's just that we can't switch off all of that awesomeness and wait till they grow into it. They have to be those people now. And, you know, learning how to not quite outsmart your kids, but learning how they think and knowing that it's normal can help us to respond in, you know, a kind and firm way. Just like you did, you were like, are you sure?
My dad used to say, you can't expect to have kids that know their own mind and also do as they're told. And it's so true, because it's so true that you have to allow them to do their own thing. One thing I was going to ask you about, Lindsay, and this is something that comes up quite a lot, and it's something that I didn't come up much when we had our kids, is the topic of co-sleeping. Because what I pick up a lot from dads is sometimes they will have got into co-sleeping, either dad's discovered it or mum's discovered it, or they've both discovered it and they've decided that it's going to be a good thing for them. But then they're run ragged because they can't sleep because the kids are sleeping with them, or they're restless when they're sleeping with them, or the rest of it. Co-sleeping wasn't really a thing wasn't kind of that well known about 10 years ago. And so generally you had either the parents that did sort of control client and kept kids in their own bedrooms as soon as they possibly could, of which we fall into that category. Then you had some of our friends probably that had kids coming out and getting into bed with them, and they were just like, well, it's easier for them to do that than me having to keep putting them back, so we'll just leave it as it is. So they kind of fell into co-sleeping sort of by necessity. I don't know what the question I'm trying to ask is. I know a lot of guys struggle with it because they're not getting any sleep. At what point do you put down something that really isn't kind of working for you and have that discussion with your partner and say, actually, this isn't working. I know we said we were going to do this, but it's not really working because I'm frazzled in the day. I can't concentrate at work because I've got no sleep because I've been sleeping next to a 3-year-old that's tossing and turning. Again, it comes back to no right and wrong, I guess, but it's just a new thing that wasn't an issue when our kids were young, if you like. So,
I think first of all, we have to acknowledge that co-sleeping is the norm for most of the world. So most cultures around the world share sleep with their kiddies. I've interviewed so many people from all over the world, from Jamaica to South Africa to India, all over the place, and co-sleeping is absolutely the norm. So we have to kind of look at it from an anthropological point of view. We all used to co-sleep. It was only really with the increase in wealth and bigger houses, more bedrooms, the ability to have separate beds that we ended up sleeping separately. So there's that kind of lens. And then there's the pragmatic one, which is it working for you? Yes, great, keep doing it. As long as it's, as safe as it possibly can be for you, and you've risk assessed it and you've made an informed choice, awesome, crack on. If it's not working for you, well, then that's when we need to have a discussion about it, because when it's not working, it's either not working for one or both parents. Now, let's say it's, let's say it's a breastfeeding mum with a toddler, and actually having them in a separate bedroom or a separate bed even would be detrimental to that breastfeeding mum's sleep. And at that point, we need to have a discussion about, well, okay, how can we compromise? Do we get a bigger bed? Do we temporarily have separate bedrooms? Do we do part-time co-sleeping? Do we, there are lots of different ways that we can compromise with that. But I often talk about, the deal breakers. And, if parents are saying, well, this is a deal breaker for me, if, co-sleeping is a deal breaker or sleep training is a deal breaker, we need to listen really carefully to that when we're in that partnership. Because if we're being put in a position where we have to endure a deal breaker, that can be quite corrosive to relationships. So that's when we need to really have a discussion about, well, what is it? What element about co-sleeping is it that you're finding difficult? Is it, waking up with toes in your face? Is it that they're an octopus and they're literally wriggling around all over the place? Is it that you feel pushed out? Is it that you feel touched out? Is it that you miss the intimacy with your partner? Specifically, what is it that's driving you mad? And let's work on that really specifically. And sometimes if there's a rift between a couple, They don't even know what's caused it. And it just takes someone to be honest and say, actually, do you know what? I'm really finding it difficult having our 5-year-old in the bed or our 2-year-old in the bed or whatever it is. We just need to be honest and say what we need. Yeah. I think I've said that before, you know, within a relationship, we need to be honest and, you know, have the guts to be able to say what it is we need. I need you to unload the dishwasher in the morning. I really need to know that I'm still loved by you. I still need to know that I'm wanted by you. All of those things can actually be the underlying issue. That it's not really about co-sleeping at all. It might be about something that is about the relationship rather than physically sharing sleep space with a small child.
Yeah.
But I think until you dig into that, you don't know what the actual problem is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know what you mean. It can be the kind of straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of something else that's going on. And I think the thing is I think that a lot of the things I find when it's kind of reported back to me in terms of kind of how guys are going through it is often the intimacy is one thing, and also the kind of the bedroom being a quiet place, a haven for mum and dad to kind of disconnect from the world around them and stuff.
Yeah.
And again, I suppose that it, in terms of what you just said, it's what is a deal breaker. If both parents are like, actually, we need that space and that haven where we don't have the kids around us, then probably co-sleeping is not going to be a good one for them, because they associate that place with a safe, quiet place, also an intimacy place as well. So I guess it's finding that compatibility in terms of what people are happy with, sort of thing. And then if one actually says, listen, we were going to give this a go and it's really not working at all, is being able to have that discussion on it.
Yeah. And sometimes if one person's saying this isn't working and the other person is saying, well, it's the only way I'm surviving, then perhaps at that point you need to say, right, okay, I hear that. What can I do to lighten your load so that we might be able to make changes at night? So, for example, you know, that sort of classic example of a younger toddler who's nursing at night, for example, you know, maybe that parent might have more energy to try and persevere with, you know, perhaps putting them back in their own sleep space if they had a reverse lion. So if the partner took the little one in the morning at, you know, the crack of dawn when they wake up at 5:30, you take them, let me have 2 hours sleep. And then actually I might feel a little bit more up for, you know, resettling at, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever, or take shifts. Like, okay, fine. Let's work on moving away from co-sleeping, but that's going to be harder. It's going to be more difficult. It's going to take longer. We're going to be more sleep deprived. So how can we share the load with that? You know, can I take the first half of the night and you take the second half of the night, for example, so that it's not all on one person? I think a lot of the time when changes need to be made with sleep, if one parent feels like, oh, great, well, that'll be me then, that's when compromise becomes a moot point, because, you know, if you're doing something because it is the way to survive, making their life harder by taking away the survival mechanism is not the way to get change, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And I think the thing is it circles really nicely back to what we were discussing earlier on, which is, and again, something that I sort of advocate with dads is to have what I would term a needs and boundaries discussion. So you work out what your needs from the relationship are. Your wife works out what her needs from the relationship are. You make those clear, and then you work out what your boundaries are going to be around those needs and which stuff is kind of, like you say, deal breakers, or what I would call, like, you know, red line stuff, what is kind of, which is orange, which is green, sort of thing. And it's working out where that is. And I think what often happens in relationships is that there is never a kind of roles, not just needs and boundaries, but a roles, needs and boundaries discussion. And then all of a sudden something happens. You're like, hang on a minute, we never agreed who was going to be doing this and who's. So it's kind of sort of roles, needs and boundaries are what I always try and get guys to work on, because when everyone's clear on what those are, okay, you're going to pass the relay baton backwards and forwards now and again in certain respects, but generally you know right, they're doing that at that this time, I'm doing that at this time, and we're going to protect each other when those things are kind of happening and stuff. And yeah, it's all part and parcel of the same thing, isn't it?
It really is. You know, you can't make changes by yourself when they're that big and they're that hard. You need backup. And you're absolutely right. That's where you need to have that discussion about, well, what's your job here? What's your role and function? What's my job? How can we work together? It's a partnership, isn't it?
We're coming back on the stuff that we've already mentioned and stuff. Lindsay, yeah. it's been a fascinating discussion. It's been really refreshing as well, because like I say, I'm coming from this as I wouldn't say my kids are older, but they're out of the baby and kind of toddler stage. And I was really curious to find out kind of what the kind of wisdom is around this at the moment, because it's just, like I say, it's something that just, I think parents really do beat them up about. So I appreciate you going through this with me today. What's the best way for people to find out about you and about, you've got a new book out, Still Awake, Responsive Sleep Tools for Toddlers and Tweens. What's the best way for people to find out about what you do?
Probably on my Instagram. I mean, I'm on all the usual socials. I'm not particularly active on Twitter, but Instagram and Facebook is the place to find me. The book is out everywhere. So it's jam-packed with loads of ideas to support sleep for older kiddies.
All right, super. Now I'm going to ask you one last question, which I don't prime any of my guests for. And that question is, Guild of Dads is all about vision plus action equaling meaning. So the question for me today, for me to you today, is, Lindsay, what is it in life that gives you meaning?
Oh, goodness. Thank you for asking me a massive question like that. It's definitely relationships. I say that actually as an introvert. And I think one of the things that's been fascinating about lockdown and the last couple of years is even the introverts have struggled with the loss of those meaningful relationships. And I just think that, you know, human beings, we were created for relationships and meaningful interactions with other people. Without that, I think a lot of us lose quite a lot of our sense of purpose and inner meaning. So yeah, for me, relationship, and that's with lots of people, my kids, my husband, my friends, my family.
I love it. Thank you very much. I ask that question to every guest, and it's always a different response. But yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today, and I've certainly learned quite a lot of interesting stuff. So I think I'm going to be applying some of this to my own parenting in the next little while. So there you go.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Thanks a lot, Lindsay. A big thanks to Lindsay for joining me. If you want to check her out, she's on Instagram. Her website is lindsayhookway.com, on which you can find out all about what she does. Her book is Still Awake, Responsive Sleep Tools for Toddlers to Tweens. And if anything resonated from this episode, link up with her or me on Instagram, or you can link up with me on Facebook if that's easier for you. There is also a video of this interview over on the Guild of Dads YouTube channel, and you can link up with me, like I say, over on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook using the handle @GuildofDads. I'm teaching you how to follow a simple system and plan, just like many of my guests, in order to transform all areas of your life so that you can live more purposefully with much greater fulfillment and meaning, at the same time as becoming the dad and man you always wanted to be. It's all in my ebook, The Dad Blueprint. You can grab it free at guildofdads.com/dad. In order to have a positive impact on the world, we improve ourselves and inspire others. The fee for this show is that you share it with others so that they may benefit from anything you find useful or interesting. Also, share the word about Guild of Dads, because I'm trying to grow this into one of the most powerful movements for men and dads in the UK and indeed across the planet. And I can only do that with you guys just like you sharing it out and spreading the word for me. If you can leave a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. That'd be really beneficial because it helps people find the podcast and tune into what we're talking about and the conversations we're having here. There are growing numbers of dads that are getting involved over on the Facebook group. So I want to thank you guys. I want to continue to grow and develop Guild of Dads as a movement and a group for dads. And you guys that listen in here on a weekly basis are imperative to making that happen. So hopefully you find something insightful in every episode. Share with the dads that you know. And in the meantime, live a life of vision, action and meaning. Apply what you hear. And we'll see you next time.